A difficult chapter for several reasons. Its length, the many pieces in it, and the subject matter. So what I thought I'd do is I'd start off with a nice story so that you like me, and then we'll get into the tough stuff. So a Baptist minister had been a member of his church, or leading his church for 10 years, and the union decided that it was time that he moved on. They had another placement for him, and so he was having to leave the church he was in. And a number of the congregants were quite upset by this, and were like, how can the union do that to us? I mean, what right do they have to snap their fingers and that you leave and we have to be, you know? And they said, we're going to write a letter to the union and tell them not to do this. And he said, no, don't. Look, don't. They have someone in mind for you. In fact, I have a letter here from the union for you, and here's what it is. He reads it out. He says, essentially, the young man they've chosen for you, he's incredibly gifted. He's a wonderful teacher. He's an incredible community builder, a wonderful pastor. You'll love him. You'll do so well with him. And a woman from the congregation pipes up and says, well, yeah, we've heard that one before. They said that last time. John 12. So I'll read, I think up to halfway, and Shirley read a chunk of the end. So, and if you want to get the whole thing all together, you'll have to read it all on your own. Is that okay? You can read? Okay. And as far as my summary, if you like, or the heart or the guts of what I want to say, I'll say that up front this time around. And then you can think about that in the context of as I read and as I talk about some things. So we want relief. We want resuscitation. We want a rescue that even if we go to the edge of almost losing everything, we want to be pulled back from that and have ourselves restored. But the rescue that Jesus is offering is the resurrection rescue, which means that you actually have to die. That the thing that we want to avoid and be saved from, the resuscitation, the relief, the rescue, it's not what Jesus really ultimately is offering. He's offering rescue, yes, but a better rescue, one that comes called resurrection, where you don't just get back what you had, you get something far better than you could ever get yourself. All right. Problem with it is that awful little thing called death. So there's a good reason why we prefer one over the other. So think about that while I talk. 6 days before the Passover. So we're already framed this around not only a rescue, but a rescue marked by death. The Passover celebrates rescue via death. Whether it be God, who his angel of death sent to kill the firstborn in Egypt to prove his power, to force Pharaoh to let Israel go, or the death of the animal, the lamb that was killed and its blood painted on the doorframe so that the angel of death would pass over. This is why we get the word Passover. Pass over those houses and not kill the firstborn in those houses. So Passover, we're already framing the story around death. Jesus therefore came to Bethany, which if you were here last week, you'll have heard a lot about that, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they gave him a dinner for him there. Martha served. Lazarus was one of those reclining with him at table. Mary therefore took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii, a year's wages, and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. And having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Jesus said, leave her alone, so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me. When the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. This has become quite a spectacle. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well as Jesus, right? Because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. The next day, the large crowd that had come to the feast heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. So they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him, crying out, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel. And Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, just as it is written, Fear not, daughter of Zion. Behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt. His disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things had been written about him and had been done to him. The crowd that had been with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to bear witness. The reason why the crowd went to meet him was that they had heard he had done this sign. So the Pharisees said to one another, You see that you're gaining nothing. Look, the world has gone after him. They're losing control. To prove their point, now among those who went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. So this is the world. These came to Philip. I wasn't there. It was some other guy. Because this guy was from Bethsaida, and I'm from Adelaide. In Galilee, and that's Adelaide's in Australia. And asked him, Sir, we wish to see Jesus. And Philip went and told Andrew, and Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. Philip never really comes out looking that great, I have to admit. He looks a little bit like a weakling. And Jesus answered them, The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Whoever loves their life loses it. And whoever hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, they must follow me. And where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor them. Those few pithy lines are the absolute heart of this chapter. If you want to know what Jesus is really trying to teach, if you want to understand what rescue he is offering and how you go about it, in this chapter, it's those words. It's those words. They anchor the whole thing. Everything pivots around that. He goes on to say, Now is my soul troubled. Right? He knows what's coming. And he's not gleefully looking forward to this. His soul is troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. Give me relief. Rescue me from this horrible moment. For this purpose, I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it and I will glorify it again. The crowd that stood there and heard it said that it had thundered. Another said, An angel has spoken to him. And Jesus answered, This voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. I think you read on from here. You were reading about the year. Yep. And we get, just to recap briefly, we get comments that though he had done many signs, they still would not believe in him. And that's according to prophecy, that the Lord would close their eyes, harden their hearts, and they would not know. And yet there were some who did believe, but they were too afraid to be open about it because they knew they would be kicked out of the synagogues, they knew they would lose social standing, they knew it would cost them. So I want to talk about three temptations. So I don't imagine I'll go too long, but then who knows? Three temptations, and I won't work them through chronologically as far as the chapter goes. I want to talk first of all about the temptation to control, and referring in this case to the chief priests, the Pharisees, those who looked at what was going on and the fame that Jesus was building and felt that they were losing control, felt that they were no longer in charge, that they were losing the battle on the hearts and minds of the populace. Look, the whole world has gone to him. What can we do? It's over. We've lost. And in that mindset is the desire, well, let's do what we can to wipe out anything that seems to give evidence to his goodness. Whatever is building his fame, let's deal with that. So, of course, the man himself. But let's get rid of Lazarus as well, because that's a really good sign. Lots of people from Jerusalem came and saw him in the tomb and saw him come out at the word of Jesus. If he's dead, then we can just say it was a nasty rumor, or it was a mass hallucination, or whatever we like to say. At the very least, we'll frighten the bejeebers out of these people. They will know who's in control. They will know who is in power if we do these things. If we kill Lazarus, and particularly if we kill Jesus. There is a temptation, and I don't think any of you are plotting murder of other people who are getting in your way. So let's use this as a metaphor for our own lives, for our own hearts. That it's not about me wanting to kill someone who offends me or gets in my way, but rather it's the resistance of my own heart in places I will not relinquish control to God. It's my own heart in places where, Lord, you can have this, you can be Lord here, but you can't be Lord here. I cannot give up control. Not of everything. I'm going to hold on to something. And it'll be different for us all. It'll be different for us all. There might be some common cultural ones. For instance, Lord, you can tell me which church to go to and so on, but you cannot tell me where to live and what school my children are going to go to. Because they are the most precious things in my world, and there's no way you are going to have control over that decision. Certainly think that in our age and in our place, children are the new idols that we worship, that are our highest priority. And then comes God. Well, that might be children, then sport, and then God. Or then children, sport, and then God. Whatever it might be. And that might not be yours. You could well be past that point. But it'll be something. There will be something in your life where the Lord might press on you and you say, well, I've done so much for you, Lord. Right? The chief priests, the Pharisees are the most devoted of God's people. It's given them a measure of control. In fact, it's given them a whole lot of control. And they can't give that up, even if God's doing something. I apologize for this week in particular, probably using more examples of my own life than perhaps is good, but I don't know any other of your stories, so I'm not going to share them. So I have gone through these processes at various levels, and I've got heaps of areas where I won't let God take control. But I have noticed this process where, to give an example, for when I was a young man with and married with a couple of kids, my ambition was career. I was moving up the ladder in public relations, doing well, and we moved from Hamilton to Auckland so that I could pursue a career in PR there and a consultancy. We were there 18 months, and in that time, though I loved the job, and I loved the place I worked, and I loved the clients, and there was just so much about it that I loved, the impact it was having on my family, I couldn't love. So we took the decision to move back from Auckland to Hamilton, and I took a job that I hated. It was the only job I had, I could get at the time, and I was in it for at least 6 months, and I went through a depression because my life was over. That pursuit of career felt like it had died because I had a higher priority, what was good for my family. So that's a death. A relinquishing of control of my life so that someone else and some others might thrive. And it hurts. It's really hard to die. And the next one was the calling to this place, which wasn't actually a calling to Chapel Hill. In fact, was a calling to give up my job. At this point, I had found a decent consultancy in Hamilton and was enjoying that. And the Lord told me clearly, give up your job. And I said, well, what then? And he said, well, you take the first step and I'll show you the next. I struggled with that. I really struggled with that. Because I'm sure like you, when you don't have an income, those things that you need income for fall away, whether it be a mortgage, putting food on the table, Martin, right? All of a sudden, those things that you take for granted become extremely vulnerable. So I struggled with that. In fact, we as a couple struggled with that. I don't know how many weeks it took. But I remember standing where I often went when I was in my lunch breaks, down by the river because I worked in town. And just that thought, how can I call myself a follower of Christ if I don't follow when he calls? All right, when it all comes down to it, it gets pretty simple. There are huge costs, potentially. But the greater cost for me was to actually not be a follower. I could have the world if I stayed in the job I was in. But what would it cost? So I wrote my letter of resignation, and he, as soon as I'd finished it, he said, great, now file it. You've said goodbye to that, and I'll tell you the next step, and that's another story. Now, and then I was a pastor. And as you might have noticed, I'm ambitious. And I thought I would do well. I certainly hoped to. I didn't come into pastoring thinking, I really hope I fail at this. Very few people do. But I have two claims to fame. I am the longest serving pastor of Chapel Hill, and of the three, the only one to have radically reduced numbers. Right? Apparently that was the Lord's will. Somehow, I mean, I don't want to over-egg that too much. I made a lot of mistakes, and that's part of the reason why the church suffered. But I'm sure also there were other things going on. And while I am not proud of the fact that the church suffered at my hands, I do take a small measure of pride that at least I'm still here. Like I often, almost probably at least once a year, say, Lord, if you don't want me here, if you want someone else, if you think someone else serves better here, take me out. Okay, allow me to step down. Yeah, I think if I said no when he was trying to get me out, he would take me out. Yeah, he loves his church too much. But within those early years, I imagined as we, you know, income halved and debts didn't, part of my thinking was, and this is where the ego comes in. Well, I may not be able to. So my metaphor for doing well in the world is the house on the hill, right? That's the house you're going to fall, which is really nice, and it has the best view, and everyone looks up to you, right? That's the metaphor of doing well in the world, for me. So I can't afford that. I'm not going to be that person. I'm not going to be the person that people look up to socially and go, wow, let's aspire to that. What an amazing, you know, that's no longer me. But you know what? Because I'm investing in this eternal kingdom, I'm going to get that in the next life. I'm going to have the eternal house on the hill, and everyone else who had the house on the hill in this world is going to look up to me. You know how easily ego creeps in and says, you just won't let go of control, will you? You're constantly pushing yourself forward. You constantly want to be in power. You constantly want to be influential. Give it up. Give it up. That's the way of eternal life. That is the eternal way. It is the voice of Jesus saying, Father, glorify your name, not glorify my name. That's the way. But we struggle to give up control, and we've all got our thing, probably many, where we struggle to trust God and let him have his way. The second is the crowd, and I want to call that the temptation to let someone else take control. So if the first one is the struggle to not let God take control, the second one is like it, the reverse of it. It's let someone else take control. Lord, be our king. I'm glad Martin used the text he did. I'll reframe a little bit of what he said. When they saw him feeding them, they didn't just want to follow him, they wanted to make him king. Because a king does two things. A king provides food, and a king protects from the enemy. And Jesus provided food by feeding the 5,000, and they wanted him to provide food for them forever. Just, you know, we don't want to even go to work. Just keep making that bread fly. And Jesus says, well, that's not the way it's going to work. You still have to work for your food. And then when they saw him raise Lazarus from the dead, it was like, wow, there is no enemy that he cannot overcome. If he has power over death, he has power over everything. Let's make him king. He can protect us from Rome, from that awful tyrant. The peace of Rome, the Pax Romana, was peace by the sword, killing all the enemies. And they saw it the same way. They thought the peace that God would bring would be destroying all these human enemies, these other empires. Kill them all, and we'll have peace, all right? The peace of the grave. So they tried to make him king. Hosanna, come, rescue us, save us. Be our king. And now they were right, weren't they? But they were wrong, too. Because Jesus said, well, if you are going to be one of mine, you need to follow me where I'm going. And you know what? That means you single seeds, you have to go into the ground and die too. This is not just me. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do it for all. And partly that means I'm going to show you that this is the way, and prove to you that this is the trustworthy path. Because who would sensibly give up their life for someone else if there wasn't something sensible at the other side of that? Why die if it's meaningless? Who would? And the temptation that we all have is, can someone else be faithful for me? Like, can I just come into a church where there is someone who is more faithful than me, who knows God better than me, who prays better than me? Can we have a worship team that can worship instead of me? Can we have a pastor or an eldership or leadership who can make faithful decisions and tell me what they are? I don't want to have these big things on my hands. You follow Christ and I'll follow you. It doesn't really work that way. Not really. Because at some point, we all have to engage in that idea of, are we going to submit to Christ or not? And if we are his servants, we'll be where he is. And that's not just for church leadership. That's not just for someone who might stand up the front. That's not just for the figureheads. There's a good reason why churches get big. It's normally there's someone really impressive in it. Yeah, exactly. You see what I'm saying, right? By implication, there's a good reason why churches get small. Someone not so impressive. Right? I am not a show worth coming to. But there are definitely shows in town worth going to. And I'm not saying they're unfaithful, the leadership of these churches. I'm just saying that the church generally is weak in that way. We go where the fame is. We go where the hype is. We go where the people are. We get caught up in the crowd and we say, well, whatever people, if you, hey, we're all going? Sure, well, it must be the right decision then. Let's all go. Group think. When Jesus isolates us and he pulls us out and he says, you're a seed, Caleb, you're a seed. You, and God sees you as a seed. He sees you. And he sees my mum, Christine. And he sees Rick. And he sees John. And he sees Graham. He says, you're a seed. And at the moment, you're just a seed. But if you die, you'll no longer be alone. You will bear much fruit. You'll be very fruitful. Many seeds will come from you. Whereas we kind of go, well, I'm a seed. Where are lots of other seeds? So we can hang out together in a seed bucket. Right? Let's none of us die. Let's just be lots of seeds together. That's how we think church growth should happen. Lots of seeds gathering together in the same place. That's not the model of Jesus. Does that make sense? In fact, we were talking about it at the beginning of the service. One of Mike Fitness's friends, quite cynical about the church at the moment, because of this very thing, he says, at the moment, this kind of northern sector of the church is the hot spot. It's the popular place to go to church. But I've seen that change. And that's moved around the city. It's not a good sign, eh? It's not a good sign of deepening Christ-likeness. So the third one is the Judas one. I've left him for last, obviously. He is a disciple of Christ. He's walked 3 years with Jesus. He's seen it all. He's lived with Jesus. He's smelled the sweat of Jesus. He's been covered in the dust of Jesus' feet. He's served with these other 11 disciples. And he's stuck with him in hard times. Again, Martin, at that point when he feeds the 5,000 and uses these really challenging words, everyone leaves but the disciples, and that included Judas, staying in there. I can imagine it must have cost them a lot to be a disciple of Jesus. And another gospel, maybe it's another one. Peter says, we have given up everything for you. We have given it all up. So they must have sacrificed a huge amount to follow Jesus, to give up their career, their future. We believe that some of them get married. Maybe they don't all get married. Maybe that they all head off into different directions and die martyrs to the cause. It was a costly lifestyle. And they were seen as the hardcore followers of Jesus, weren't they? Wherever he went, they went. Last week, he's coming back to Bethany. It's under a death sentence. Well, we'll go with him so we can die with him. It's a statement of commitment. And yet we find in this story Judas, who, when he witnesses this extravagant love gift of Mary on Jesus, his response seems initially very noble. Hang on a minute. What a waste. This should have been sold and given to the poor. But Jesus diagnoses his heart pretty astutely, yeah, as you'd expect. Leave her alone. This was an amazing thing she's done. I think in Matthew it says that she has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. And I think that's literal, right? Jesus is going to go. He's not only will he die, and he goes in that sense, but even when he's resurrected after 50 days, he ascends and he is gone. He's not, you know, walking around, and we can't feel the sweat of Jesus at the moment. I also think that it's deeper than that. I also think he's talking about Judas's own heart. Because who was the poorest in that room? Surely it would be Judas himself. Like, maybe not materially, though possibly. But the poverty in that story is not the poor people who don't have this 300 denarii. It's poor old Judas who wanted to skim off the top. Who's got to this point in his journey as a disciple and thought, you know, it's cost me too much. I've gone a long way with Jesus. It doesn't seem really to be going that well. I'm going to start clawing a little back for myself. I've come as far as I'm willing to go. The temptation for those who've journeyed a long time with Jesus is to get to a point and go, I'm done. I've had enough. It's cost me too much. And I will continue to look like a follower. I will use all the right words. I am now familiar with the kinds of things that Jesus might say, like, well, why don't we think about the poor? Such a concern that Jesus had. It seemed like the right thing. We become familiar with the way that we should look as Christians, with the way we should talk as Christians, all the while in our heart pulling back. So it's cost me too much already. I'm out. I'm going to start taking a little bit for myself. From this common purse, from this community, I'm going to start drawing something for myself. Because I have paid too high a price. I'm not willing to pay another. Judas is a classic example of preferring relief, rescue from restoration, resuscitation. Give me back what I lost, Jesus. I want out. I want to sell my shares. Give me back what I've lost. I'm not going any further. This is such a temptation for us, isn't it? Because we all pay a price to follow Jesus. It might just be that people think less of you because you are one of those weird religious types. It might be that every Sunday morning on a regular basis, maybe, you come here when it's a beautiful day outside. It's cost you a Sunday morning. It might be that it costs you money, that you tithe, that you give regularly. And you wonder why. It might be that you've just served so hard in the church. You've given yourself at so many levels. And again, you think, for this? For here? Why? If I were to make that decision again, I wouldn't have done it. Give it back. I can't get it back. I'll take what I can. The temptation to have come so far that we want to pull back now. That we get to the point of our death and we don't want it. And Mary's extravagant gift just was like a sword in his heart. It offended him at the level of, she has gone somewhere in her faith that I just cannot go and I will not go and I hate her for it. How dare she make me look so bad? How dare she do something so beautiful for Jesus, so extravagant, so generous, even as I am taking from the common purse for myself? How dare she? His worst act of thievery is trying to define her goodness as something wrong. Trying to rob from her and from Jesus this beautiful and intimate moment. Trying to sully it. Trying to pitch it as, well, she's wasteful. Why isn't she thinking of the poor? That's his worst act, isn't it? Because he will see Jesus in the same way. It reminded me of the story of Peter and Mark when Jesus announces for the first time, I am going to die. And what does Peter do? He takes him aside and rebukes him. No, you don't. No, no, Lord. This is not going to happen. And what does Jesus do? Seeing that everyone is watching, he says to Peter, the most loving words, get behind me, Satan. What does Satan mean? The accuser. What does Judas do? He accuses. And the next turn of phrase is fascinating too. Because you don't have in mind the things of God, but the things of humans. Which I find fascinating. Satan thinks like a person? Anyway. So this is our struggle. We can't easily think like God. We think always in terms of what we're losing, where we lack, to conserve what little we have, to hold on to whatever control that gives us comfort and security. We do everything we can to avoid death, to avoid real loss. But Jesus doesn't think like that. The Father doesn't think like that. The Spirit doesn't think like that. The Son says, Father, glorify your name. And the Father says, I have and I will, and I'll do it by glorifying your name. And the Spirit says, yeah, let's do that together. Mary's incredible gift is the sign, the symbol, the path forward, that if you have come so far, the answer is not to pull back, it is to go further, further in. If you can't get out, get in deeper. If you're in with Jesus, don't think about what it's costing you. Think about what more you can give. And don't just give something. Ask him. That's what I meant to say. Ask him, Lord, what else? Where else? How else? Because I imagine the resurrection life is going to be pretty good. I imagine that if my life currently just continued forever, I would want out at some point. I just don't have the energy for it. This resurrection life, I think, is better, richer. I think it's a life of generosity. I think it's a life that pours out, trusting that God pours in. I used Romans 5 a fair bit last week to talk about the idea of rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And I want to finish that with verse 5. Hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. The Christian life in the end is a pouring out life, isn't it? It's a pouring out life. It doesn't make human sense. It feels like a great risk, and it is. Which is why we need Jesus to go before us, to show us the way, and then to lead us individually along that path. That wherever you're at with the Lord, wherever you're at in your discipleship, the only step you have to take is the next one forward. You don't need to nail yourself to a cross tomorrow. Jesus built up to that over 3 years and died at the right time. There will be many deaths along the way. Death to our ego, death to our ambition, death to ourself. Many little challenges along the way that train us in the way of the Lord. The only thing you need to worry about is your next step. You don't compare yourself to anyone else. You don't try and be Jesus tomorrow. Just follow his Spirit. Whatever you pour out for him, he will pour more back in. And I only have his word in my own experience to back that up. So you'll need to trust his word and your own experience to lean on as well. Any reflections? Say again. Why doesn't someone think of about the Lord? Yeah, right. So again, for podcasts, Graham's asking, well, I've been saying people don't think like the Lord, we don't think like God, and why not? At least some of us should, just by chance. And, of course, being made in his image. Well, that's an interesting observation. I would certainly say this, Graham, the fact that you're here proves that someone is. Someone's thinking about the Lord, and someone's thinking the Lord's thoughts and trusting the Lord's ways. Well, why else are you here? Yeah. How do you mean? That's right. Yeah. That is the gift of the community. Yes, that we bring our strengths. We also bring our weaknesses in. And I love that image of the seed. Unless we die, we stay alone. And I know that you can easily preach the high cost of following Christ. And it's true, it needs to be preached. But I know too that the other side of it is such much greater richness. The fact that if you commit to a people and you find some people committing back, there's nothing like it. You can count the cost of that commitment, and that's one way of approaching it, but what about the benefits? You know, on any given day, you might think, man, I've just sacrificed too much for this place. I've put up with all these people. And then you realize, hang on a minute, they've put up with you. You're just darn lucky that they're still there. You know, that we each come along and look at each other in the eye and say hello. I mean, that's rare. You'd have to join a club for something like it. And the church is not a club. It's something weirder than that. It's from birth to death kind of be with each other sort of thing. That doesn't make human sense. It shows there must be the mind of Christ at work among his people.
I have a quote on my wall from an old Archbishop of Canterbury, you would have heard it, that God calls us to a place where we do not want to go, along a road that we do not want to travel.
Yeah, it's good. God calls us to a place we don't want to go, along a road we don't want to travel, to a place we don't want to leave. Yep. I could certainly say, and again, forgive me for using my own life as an example, this has by far been the hardest job. And I would never call it a job, but easily the most rewarding. And the two realities are the same. It is because it's been so hard that it's so rewarding. It's because it's been so hard that I think I'm a slightly better person than when I started. And that's a success. That's probably the only measure of success that we could ever hope for. I'm slightly better when I died than when I was born. You know, let's hope for that. There's some movement there. Anyone else? Yeah. Control, eh? Who wants to give it up? It's hard enough to get it.